According to my notes, we have students from Gateway Technical College. Is that correct? If they would please stand. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Gateway Technical College has also appeared a number of times in prior years with our Court with Class program, whereby we invite students across the state to join us for an oral argument. They are given materials about the case that they will hear, and we'll meet with a justice who's assigned for the day to meet with students and discuss the procedures that the court uses to take a case, hear a case, decide a case, and issue an opinion. The substantive issues of the cases will not be discussed, and everyone is invited to join the students after this case to discuss our procedures. Does anyone in the courtroom want a summary of the case we are about to hear? If so, raise your hand, please, and the marshal will give you a summary. Seeing no hands, I'll move to the next order of business, which is to introduce the court. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser is the justice with whom you'll meet after this case. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case, 2012 AP 1967, Data Key Partners versus Primera Advisors, LLC. Now, we have a lineup of attorneys. First will be Michael Hapfield, in that you have 15 minutes, Mr. Hapfield, according to this. We then have Jonathan Meadow, whom you will introduce, Pro Hoc Vici from California, representing the Pauls, who you represent also, according to my notes, for 10 minutes. 30 minutes of Richard Buraldi of New York City, representing Data Key Partners, introduced by Stacy Tauber of her law offices. And then, Mr. Apfeld, you have 5 minutes. Is that the lineup is agreed upon? All right. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Michael Apfeld, and I represent the directors of Renaissance Learning other than Terrence and Judith Paul, who are represented by Mr. Meadow, seated beside me. Now, dividing oral argument is never easy, and in this case, there will certainly be some overlap between the issues. Keeping that in mind, I would like to first address the issue that appears to have driven the Court of Appeals decision, which is the supposed impropriety of even considering the director immunity statute and the business judgment rule on a motion to dismiss. Now, business judgments are not made in a vacuum, and even though it's often said that we live in a world of infinite possibilities, reading the well-pleaded allegations of fact contained in the complaint, we see that the directors of Renaissance Learning had precisely three possibilities before them, presented in the form of two binary choices. The first choice was whether to spurn the advances of Primera and remain independent, or negotiate with and ultimately to sell to Primera. And the second choice, presented only after a deal with Primera had been inked, was whether to stick with Primera or to abandon that agreement and sell to the newcomer Plato. Now, the trial court held that because the complaint did not allege facts showing bad faith, self-dealing, dishonesty, or willful misconduct in making either of these decisions, the directors were protected by both the immunity statute and the business judgment rule, and so dismissed the complaint.
What's the difference between the immunity statute and the business judgment rule?
Well, I'm not sure that any decision by this court has ever elaborated on that distinction. But the primary distinction is that the business immunity statute is an immunity against liability in damages for the directors.
You want the business judgment rule to be so read.
I'm sorry?
You want the business judgment rule to be so read as a business immunity rule.
No, the business immunity statute is itself an immunity. And the business judgment rule is, in a certain respect, broader because it applies to all forms of judicial intervention.
Okay, so what are you relying on the statute or not relying on
we
the
are
statute?
Definitely relying on the statute.
Okay.
We are relying on both.
Do you think that's narrower than the business judgment rule?
I'm not certain, Your Honor, and I'm not certain that it is necessary to explore the fringes of potential differences between them.
Okay, certainly. So I'll repeat my first question. Do you view the statute a business judgment rule?
I'm sorry, I really did not understand it.
Do you view the statute like a business judgment rule?
It is founded in the same interests as the business judgment rule, and there is a great deal of overlap between the two.
So I wanted to know.
In turning to whether or not it is appropriate or even necessary to address the statute and the rule on a motion to dismiss, I think it's important to stress what this case is not about. This case is not about a lack of specificity. This case is not about notice pleading. This case is about whether the specific facts that a plaintiff has chosen to allege may be tested against the standards of both the statute and the rule. That means the facts alleged, not the conclusions of law contained in the complaint.
Does it make a difference whether the business judgment rule is deemed an evidentiary presumption or a legal presumption in your argument?
I believe it is both. If you look at both, let's examine, if you will, both the business judgment rule and the immunity statute. The business judgment rule establishes both a standard governing all forms of judicial intervention in corporate affairs and a presumption of good faith on the part of the directors. The immunity statute defines the very terms on which liability may be imposed, setting forth a general rule of non-liability, and then specifying what a plaintiff must do to overcome that rule of non-liability. So it is not as though these are some exceptions to some underlying duties. They define the duties themselves. In other words, they establish the very elements of the claim, and it is, I would say, elementary that any plaintiff must plead the essential elements mm-hmm. of a claim.
So when I read some cases, whether it's Einhorn or I have in front of me the Reget case that says, procedurally, the business judgment rule creates an evidentiary presumption that the acts of the board of directors were done in good faith and the honest belief that its decisions were in the best interest of the company. That's citing Delaware, chapter 1971, and then a Gauger case here in Wisconsin. And so that's why, in part, I asked the question. It looks to me like the case law indicates that it's an evidentiary rule, but you're saying not so.
I believe not so. I believe it is an evidentiary rule, but I believe it's much more than an evidentiary rule. And I think that there has been a line of cases that stretches far back in Wisconsin jurisprudence that apply the business judgment rule to various factual situations. And I do not believe that any court, either this court or a court of appeals, has ever said, it is only an evidentiary presumption.
No, but oftentimes in reading, it's almost by a negative, negative pregnant, you know. when it says, procedurally, the business judgment rule creates an evidentiary presumption without and is silent as to whether or not it's a legal presumption, it suggests to me that that's what they mean. That it is evidentiary and not legal, but problem, you say.
I would disagree, Your Honor. I believe that if you looked only at the Reget case and you focused only on that statute, and perhaps if that's what the Reget case was even concerned about, the distinction, those words might support the narrow reading. But I think that if you look at the entirety of the jurisprudence of Wisconsin on the business judgment rule, you'll see it is more than that. And it is, in fact, it has been applied to strike pleadings. Some of these cases are older, but if you examine the cases, there is nothing about the difference between the past rules and the present rules that provides any reasoned basis for distinguishing between those cases.
Counselor, I'm sorry, did you finish?
No. Go ahead.
Okay. If I understood you correctly, what you said is in order to state a claim for breach of fiduciary duty of a director, you have to plead facts sufficient to support an exception under sub 1 of 180.0828. Correct?
I think it's one or four. Those are the only arguable ones. And if I have phrased it, it is simply because that is the way the business immunity statute is itself phrased. It begins with a rule of non-liability,
right,
and it sets forth several exceptions. So if you want to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, you must
plead an exception.
Plead an exception.
Okay.
Yes.
So just so I understand it, so that's one of your bases for saying that this matter should be dismissed in regard to the directors, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. What about in regard to the Pauls, who are still a part of this suit for their activities as a majority shareholder? Do you think that statute has any bearing on their still being potentially liable in this lawsuit?
Well, Your Honor, of course, I'm sure that Mr. Meadow will want to address that very same question in more detail. But I think that, in as much as the Pauls are being criticized for their role as directors, it absolutely applies to them.
Right.
In as much as they are being attacked for their role as shareholders, I think that there is probably no reason for the rule to apply, simply because the rights of majority shareholders are really much broader than the rights of the directors as a whole, and so there has been no need to develop an analog to the business judgment rule vis-a-vis shareholders acting in their capacity as such.
Okay, so what your short answer to my rather rambly question is that 180.0828 really focuses on the directors, and you will let your colleague deal with
The immunity statute is specifically directed at directors and not shareholders. That's correct. If I can turn back, though, to the question.
Jeffo, before you do that, let me ask you this. After looking carefully at the Court of Appeals decision, I certainly have some insight into the approach they took. And it appears to me that the approach that was taken by the Court of Appeals looked at what's appropriate in a motion to dismiss situation as against a summary judgment action. Do you see that tension also here?
I think it fairly clear that the Court of Appeals was basically saying this is something that we will not address until we get to the summary judgment stage. And I believe that is incorrect for at least a couple of different reasons.
Right. That's what I want you to tell me.
And the first reason is that it is, I believe, a most artificial distinction. Standard summary judgment methodology says step number one is examine the pleadings to see whether they state a claim upon which relief can be granted, and if they do not, stop right there. So this very same inquiry that we are asking the court to undertake will eventually be undertaken. The second reason that I think that it is an unnecessary delay is that this motion accepts the facts alleged, the well-pleaded facts alleged in the complaint as true. So the question is not whether or not they will be able to adduce evidence to support those facts. The motion to dismiss assumes they will and says, fine, even if they prove it, it doesn't state a claim upon which relief can be granted. But there are other reasons why we should not wait until summary judgment to take up these issues. I mean, waiting to summary judgment will at least in part defeat the very purpose of the business judgment rule itself, you know, which finds its foundation in the premise that courts should avoid, to the extent possible, interfering in the governance of corporations. So if you defer it until the summary judgment stage, you will have sanctioned, at least in part, some interference in corporate affairs.
Counsel, who pays the attorney fees for the lawyers representing the directors?
Well, I suppose as a general proposition, that might differ from corporation to corporation. But in this case, the fees of the directors are ultimately paid by the corporation. And
who pays the fees for Data Key Partners?
The fees for Data Key Partners
are not paid by the corporation.
They are not paid by the corporation, no.
Okay. So extending this case costs the plaintiffs, and costs the corporation.
Yes, it does.
I just wanted to check.
No,
okay.
It does. And in addition, as we've tried to point out in our briefs, there is a high societal cost of waiting as well. Now, that's excruciatingly true in the context of mergers, and we've talked about the merger tax, and I don't need to elaborate it. I think it's clear from the briefs. But it goes beyond mergers. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, all of this is finished, right?
The merger, in fact, did take place.
And
yes.
It took place. So yes. All we are dealing with here is whether there should be any transfer of funds. Right? The minority shareholders and the majority shareholders.
As between these
and
parties.
And damages yes. against the directors.
As between these parties, yes. But the rule, of course, that we are discussing goes beyond this particular case. And it will apply to future mergers. It will apply to other forms of corporate governance. And it will have particular importance in any case involving a corporation owned by or controlled by a distinguishable majority, because if you believe, if you accept what the Court of Appeals has ruled, mere allegations of a potential to exercise undue influence is enough to get you past the motion to dismiss.
Well, you've got two public policies, don't you? One is that you ought to leave the direction of the management to the corporation, to the managers. They have to exercise discretion, and you call it business judgment, and they should be free from outside control. On the other hand, you've got people who have invested in an entity, a corporate entity, and the law gives them protections against a misuse of their investment and abuse of their investment, right?
Yes. I mean, those are the two policies.
Those are the two balances.
Yes.
And to the extent that the courts are not willing to do much or anything in overseeing the corporation, then you've got a issue about you will reduce investment because there's no protection for a minority shareholder.
I presume I may answer, Your Honor.
So how do you make the balance? I mean, we've got let me just continue since I've got a red light. We have a complaint here that runs many, many pages, seems to have a lot of facts, has a lot of conclusions. So how do you make the balance? And two, what should have this complaint said?
I agree that there are two competing public interests. I also believe that these competing public interests have been balanced, in the one instance, by the legislature that requires proof of, in essence, willful misconduct in order to recover any damages, and by this court and many other courts in the gradual evolution, development and evolution of the business judgment rule, which requires proof of what is in essence the same as willful misconduct, although the formula is different over the period of time. The minority is still has available to it quite a number of protections, including judicial remedies for fraud, overreaching, typical freeze-out situations, and that sort of thing, none of which is apparent here. And they also have the additional remedy that if they do not like the ownership of the corporation, they may sell their shares in the open market and choose to invest their funds elsewhere.
I guess the total number of directors for Renaissance was what?
It is, well, they are all named in the current complaint other than one director who, for reasons unknown, was simply dropped out of the last complaint. So that would be?
Eight?
Yes, eight directors.
Well, the Pauls voted in a particular way. How did the other directors vote?
Well, all directors voted to approve. First they voted to approve the original deal with Permira, and ultimately, they voted to approve the modified deal with Permira, and hence not to accept the Plato deal. It was unanimous, if that's the question, Your Honor.
Including the eighth director?
Yes.
Was there some special benefit derived by the six directors who weren't the Pauls?
The plaintiff has alleged that there is a conflict that the directors suffered under because of their stock rights, which would be triggered upon the sale, the change of control of the corporation. These stock rights were established years before this episode. So they were pre-existing stock rights. And as we've tried to point out in the brief, stock rights do not constitute a conflict of interest. They, in fact, align the interests of the directors with those of the minority shareholders. If these directors suffered under any interest that was not the same as the other shareholders, it would be their directors' fees, which would motivate them to stay entrenched with the corporation rather than to sell.
Counselor, if their stock rights that were triggered by the sale, wouldn't they have been triggered by the sale to Plato?
Yes.
So whether they sold to one company or the other makes no difference?
It's a matter of indifference to them.
Chief, if I may, in looking at
Bradley,
thank you. In looking at the complaint or the amended complaint with regard to this issue, it's at Supplemental Appendix 271, and it deals, as a follow-up to Justice Prosser's question, it deals with, in part, the allegation of improper personal profits. In JA on page 271, the complaint asserts that the Pauls' divestiture of their Renaissance stock in pursuit of their retirement and diversification plans led to improper personal profits, and that the BCLS license agreement did also. With regard to the next page on C in the Board of Directors, it says payments to the board, to the directors for their restricted stock and restricted units. Now, you're talking about that these stock rights are of long consequence, but does that of long consequence tie into the allegation of the complaint or the validity, for purposes of pleading, the validity of the allegation?
If I may, shall I first at least focus on the stock rights? Because Your Honor mentioned a couple of different elements there. The stock rights, and I don't think for purposes of our analysis there is really any difference between the restricted stock units and the other stock rights. They all vest on the sale of the company. I believe it is the plaintiff's theory that that somehow created a motivation on the part of these directors to fall head over heels to sell the corporation rather than to hold on. But that is an illogical argument. I mean, first, the courts have simply held that the ownership of stock rights doesn't constitute a conflict of interest. But that would have to assume that for some reason these directors were wanted to fall head over heels to give away their rights for less than they were actually worth. And that doesn't make any sense. Now, and that's how I believe it, the plaintiff attempts to work that into their theory of the case and why it does not, in fact, work. Now, would Your Honor like me to address the other things that you mentioned?
I'm going to pass just because of time and the red light that's on, but thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. And now I understand that as a member in good standing myself of the State Bar of Wisconsin, it is both my duty and my honor to introduce my co-counsel, Jonathan Meadow of Mayor Brown, who is a member of good standing of the State Bar of Illinois and who represents Tariff and Judith Paul.
Thank you. Ms. Meadow, you're welcome to the State Bar of Wisconsin for purposes of arguing for the Pauls this morning.
Very much, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Jonathan Meadow. I am here on behalf of Terrence and Judith Paul, who have been joined, as been noted, as both direct in their capacities as directors and shareholders. Mr. Apfel has spoken to this point about the potential liabilities of directors. My focus will be on the shareholder side, though as some of my comments will overlap with the director issues in part. In analyzing the Paul's potential exposure as shareholders, I think it is useful to talk about the three options that Mr. Apfel did make reference to. That was, one option was to support a transaction with Plato. A second option was to support no transaction, have the company remain independent. And the third was to support the transaction with Permira. And the issue here is, have the plaintiffs pleaded anything to suggest that the Pauls breached their fiduciary duties as shareholders by not following the first two paths and by, in fact, following the third? Our answer to that is no, and I think it's helpful to look at each scenario individually because the issues do vary somewhat by scenario. So let's take the first one, Plato. Did the Pauls breach their obligations by not supporting a transaction with Plato? The answer to that is simply no, because all shareholders, minority, majority, all shareholders are free to dispose of their property, which is what their stock is, their property as they see fit. That's been the law of this state since at least 1886 in this court's decision in In Re Petition of Klaus. It was forcefully restated just 2 years ago in Delaware by then Chancellor, now Chief Justice Strine in the In Re Synthes, S-Y-N-T-H-E-S case. We know of no court, and certainly none has been cited, by plaintiff that has held that a majority shareholder has a duty or an obligation to support a transaction they, in fact, oppose. So turn to the next scenario, remaining independent. Did the Pauls, again, the issue, is anything alleged that suggests the Pauls breached the duty by not withdrawing their support from all mergers? And the answer, again, is no. And the reason here is, as even plaintiff admits, at a minimum, the Pauls were free to sell their stock in a private sale if they wanted to. And that was theoretically a possibility. But again, we know of no principle of law or case that suggests this was mandatory and that this was the only way the Pauls could proceed. If you go again to the Synthes case in Delaware, I think Chancellor Strine put it best when he asked, why would you possibly want a majority shareholder to do this? Because if a private sale happened, well, the Pauls make out fine. They get their premium. In fact, they get the whole premium. They don't share any of it with the minority. And the minority now is stuck still a minority, but now with a controller they didn't even pick. So if you're looking at it from the standpoint of a minority shareholder, that seems, frankly, to be probably the worst option. So that then leaves option three, which was taken, Premier. And again, the issue is anything alleged that would suggest that the Pauls breached any obligations wearing the majority shareholder hat by supporting the Permira deal?
What is the obligation of the majority shareholder?
Well, I think it's situation specific. We do not deny, as a general matter, there are fiduciary obligations. It's a question of putting content on that. And in this case, nothing has been alleged to suggest a breach.
I know, but tell me what the fiduciary obligation is. I know what a fiduciary obligation is generally, but what, as a majority shareholder, what obligation do I have to the minority shareholders? Do I have an obligation not to take excessive compensation? Do I have an obligation to protect their rights when there's a sale? What's my obligation? I mean, it's my property. I can sell my property at whatever price I want. What's my obligation to them?
To them, the case law is not developed. In Wisconsin in particular, the only cases that have been cited, and this may be the one point on which we agree with the Court of Appeals, where they said these cases really don't apply here. We agree. But if you look at the Jorgensen case, which was a Court of Appeals decision, there you had majority shareholders violating contracts, kicking the minority off the board, ceasing payments to the minority, taking the payments all for themselves. That was found to be, at least for, I think it was summary judgment purposes, a potential breach. The only other case from Wisconsin, at least, that has been cited was the Grognet case from this court, which really dealt with a majority shareholder's invocation of Fifth Amendment rights at a deposition. So it's pretty far afield. So it's a little hard to answer, Chief Justice, in the abstract. Those are the points, at least in Wisconsin. We agree with the Court of Appeals. They really don't say much of anything of use here.
Is there, not in the abstract, but in the concrete, is there a fiduciary duty of full disclosure in connection with the sale agreement?
Some courts have so held. In this case, there was a claim of inadequate disclosure. That claim was also dismissed by the trial court. The Court of Appeals, in fact, affirmed that dismissal, and no cross-appeal or petition was filed here. So that's not an issue in the case at this point. If you look at in a sale context, where majority shareholders can potentially run into trouble, I think falls into two headings. One, when they're on both sides of the deal. And the second, when they take disproportionate consideration.
Mr. Meadow, would you explain to me what was going on with the allegations concerning the licensing agreement that the majority shareholders were involved with?
That, I think, gets to the disproportionate consideration. And just as background, recall here, we start from the premise that the minority is, in fact, getting a lot more in cash per share than the Pauls are. Under the Premira deal, the Pauls were getting $15 a share, minorities getting $16.60, 11% more almost. That's where they got, as a result of which, the minority was realizing a 40% premium over the stock price prior to the transaction. The aggregate amount of that greater than pro rata recovery by the minority was roughly $10 million. So they start out $10 million to the good. Now, plaintiff says, yeah, but there's also this agreement as part of the deal, and it's alleged, I believe, in paragraph 62, that a company controlled by the Pauls received, and I'm quoting here, a non-exclusive, non-transferable license to use current and future software products and services for the internal educational use of family and descendants of the Pauls. And I take it they're trying to suggest that was some kind of disproportionate benefit to the Pauls, not shared, a benefit to the majority, not shared with the minority. There's simply no allegation here that would permit an inference to that. Again, our minority is starting out $10 million to the good. There is no allegation that suggests this non-commercial license has any value anything close to $10 million. There's not even an allegation here that this license was on preferential or non-market terms. The concern when a majority shareholder is getting disproportionate consideration, I believe, is the notion that an acquirer is only going to pay so much for a company. And if the majority is getting more than their fair share, that's going to come out of the hide of the minority. But here in a situation where, at best, the majority has already contributed $10 million to the minority, and then on top of it, okay, they get a non-commercial license, but if it's on market terms, there's simply no basis on which to infer that Permira was giving up anything it would need to recoup from the minority. So I don't think that allegation about the license, we see it in the complaint, but particularly on the facts here where it's if anything, a disproportionate recovery in favor of the minority, this certainly cannot tilt the balance in the other way, given the lack of allegations that this was on anything preferential or a non-market basis. So we don't have a situation. This is clearly not a case where the majority shareholder is on both sides. There's no allegation that the Pauls had any relationship or connection with Permira. They don't have equity in Permira. They don't have a job with Permira. None of those types of things. So it's not a case where the majority shareholder is on both sides. It is not a case where the majority shareholder is getting disproportionate consideration. If anything, they are funding a disproportionate consideration in favor of the minority. I see my red light is on.
Let me just ask
Justice
you,
Crook.
is that issue, the disproportionate share issue, something that you think is appropriately resolved on a motion to dismiss rather than on summary judgment?
I do, Your Honor. It has been in the Synthes case in Delaware. What Chief Justice Strine said there was when a majority shareholder has a right, the majority has the control in the company. If it technically has the right to the whole premium for control. But we don't want that. So if instead the majority spreads out the premium and agrees to a pro rata recovery, that's a good thing. And in his words, that's a safe harbor. And he's saying this on a motion to dismiss. That is a safe harbor from liability, both for the majority shareholders and the directors who approve the deal as well. That's the overlap here. In our situation, not only did the Pauls make sure there was pro rata, they funded, in effect, a disproportionate recovery in favor of the minority. They are certainly within the safe harbor recognized by Chancellor, now Chief Justice Strine, and again, that was on a motion to dismiss.
We have a safe harbor in Wisconsin?
There's no court that has so held. To this point, again, the issue really hasn't come up. These cases do tend to arise in Delaware, just given the prevalence of Delaware incorporation, and that tends to be where the litigation is and is most developed, and that is the current law in Delaware.
What about the fact that the Pauls were indemnified? And
well,
what about the fact that Goldman Sachs was the Pauls' advisor or investment banker and was also on the other side of giving favorable fairness opinions. Isn't that what it is? I'm reading from 64.
I'm sorry, I lost
I'm reading from paragraph 64. That's what 64 is the Goldman Sachs, 62E is the indemnification.
You know, the indemnification, I think, is simply a recognition of the reality of the world we live in, which was pointed out in the papers. Mr. Apfel alluded to it, that every deal today, doesn't matter what the terms are, every deal gets sued upon. So I don't really think you can draw any inferences beyond that. With respect to Goldman Sachs, we saw the allegations. The fact is there's no allegation that Goldman's ultimate analysis was wrong, was manipulated, was improper. That allegation just does not appear in the complaint. Remember, too, here, the importance of a fairness opinion is somewhat reduced in this case because you had an actual bidding war that went on. So you saw the market forces playing out. Shareholders could see that. They didn't have to rely solely on a fairness opinion from an investment banker.
But their fee was entirely according to the allegation, which we assume is true. Goldman Sachs' fee was entirely their fee would only of $8.9 million, which I suppose is a small amount for Goldman Sachs, is a contingent on consummation of the transaction.
That is alleged. That's not atypical.
Not typical.
In these types of transactions. I'm sorry?
Atypical.
I'm sorry. It is not atypical.
Okay,
it is common.
It's common, better.
It's common in these types of transactions. And again, I mean, there's no coherent allegation here that these sums would somehow be enough to, corrupt the opinion of Goldman Sachs, or that the Pauls had that kind of sway over them, which I think is the nature of the allegation here.
They need to say that this is atypical, that Goldman Sachs would be swayed by this? I'm trying to figure out what you wanted in this complaint.
Well, what we want is sustained. Well, I think if you step back, Your Honor, what the plaintiff has tried to do in this complaint is try to suggest there's something else going on here besides just a disagreement over which deal was better. Because if that's all we're talking about, the Pauls thought the Primera deal was better. His guys thought Plato was better. If that's all we're talking about, that is precisely the type of dispute courts don't referee. That is what the business judgment rule is about. It is you leave it to the business judgment of the directors of the company. And if you don't want to buy into a company where you can be outvoted because there's a majority shareholder, don't buy into that company. So what they're trying to do is suggest, no, there's more going on here. It wasn't just a disagreement and we got outvoted. It was, in fact, you guys, defendants, were lining your pockets. You were, either the license, the restricted stock rights that vested, this notion about liquidity, that the Pauls, needed a deal because of liquidity. I mean, this came up again in the Synthes case in Delaware, where Chancellor Strine, again, I keep forgetting, he's Chief Justice now, said there is a safe harbor. He recognized an exception. The exception was if the majority shareholder is under a crushing liquidity need, and they just need a deal because they need cash immediately, then you have reasons to look harder at the transaction, and there could be something there. But he said, it's a very narrow exception, his terms, and you need allegations of an actual crisis. I think it, again, is his term. And there's nothing alleged here like that. There's nothing alleged here like that, that the Pauls had to have a deal to raise cash. That's just not here. So what they need to do is I know what they're trying to do, and they're trying to do the right thing, which is try to show or allege a set of facts that this is something other than just a business disagreement over which deal was better. And the problem they have is they just haven't done it. They've tried, and they just haven't done it.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
May I ask?
Justice Prosser.
The $13 million termination fee, does that involve Goldman Sachs, or what is that?
No, that was a breakup fee. Where if, in fact, because remember, by the time Plato comes on the scene, there's already a deal with Primera. There's a contract. And one of the terms of the contract was what was called a fiduciary out. So if a better deal came along, the board could take it. But, you know, Primera had invested a lot of money in this deal, and they had protections. Again, this is common in these types of transactions. It was a $13 million breakup fee. So if, in fact, the board decided we're going to ditch Primera and go with Plato, they'd have to pay Primera $13 million. I mean, that's certainly a consideration that comes into play when you decide what's the best course for the corporation and all shareholders.
One question. Why would the majority shareholders be interested in giving this extra $10 million to the minority shareholder? I mean, just charity? What is it?
I think it was, number one, they thought the better deal was Primera. At the time this was done, just to review the bidding, Primera made the initial offer at $14.85 a share. Plato came in at $15.50. The Pauls, there was some back and forth, the Pauls believed the Primera deal was better, and they were willing to, Primera was willing to pay to match the $15.50 in overall terms to make it a better deal for the minority. The Pauls said, we won't take $15.50, we'll take $15, give and make it up with the minority to $16.60. I think, the fairest inference is it was an attempt to end any debate, frankly, over which was the better deal, to make sure nobody could complain about it. Things didn't turn out that way, as they don't in this world. You get sued on every case. That happens, but that, I think, is what was going on. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Brualdi, you're going to be moved to appear pro hoc vici by Attorney Stacy Teuber. Ms. Teuber.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Stacy Teuber. I am a member in good standing of the Wisconsin State Bar, and I am pleased to introduce Mr. Richard Brualdi, a Madison transplant to New York. He is a member in good standing of the New York Bar.
Thank you, counsel. Welcome to Wisconsin, Mr. Brualdi.
Good morning, Your Honor. As Ms. Teuber pointed out, I actually grew up here and moved to New York as a young adult. I understand Your Honor did the reverse, beginning in New York and moving
right
here to Wisconsin.
Which goes to show I'm smarter.
Well, I...
May it please the court. That's your response.
I was going to say that at least based on our careers to date, it shows that the state of Wisconsin got the better part of that deal, but I think I still have a few more years to go, so maybe I will catch up. I guess we'll see.
All right. We'll watch.
Okay. Respectfully, before I turn to the statute and the law, and I will do there, I think there are three policy issues that the court ought to keep in mind underlying this case today. First, as Chief Justice Abrahamson alluded to before, this is the only check that shareholders of a public company have against alleged self-dealing, against alleged breaches of fiduciary duties by the majority shareholders. This is not something the SEC regulates. The SEC only regulates disclosures. This case is it. And to the extent that the court shuts off shareholders' ability to challenge alleged transactions in court, it will inhibit the ability of Wisconsin corporations to do business in what is, after all, a national economy. Second, and this also goes to those public policy issues, I know the court doesn't decide issues based on newspaper articles, but this transaction was critiqued by the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, both of whom strongly suggested, at a minimum, that significant discovery was appropriate here. Now, somebody who reads those or tries to read those two newspapers every day, I could tell you there is very little that they agree upon. It's two very different views of the world. The fact that they both agree that something was going on at Renaissance and that discovery is needed, respectfully, ought to speak volumes. The third thing I will note is that Wisconsin manufacturers submitted a brief in support of asking this court to grant certiorari, to grant review. We submitted a brief actually opposing their motion to file a brief. Their motion to file an amicus brief was stamped approved by the court. I'm not sure if any of the justices actually saw our brief in opposition to their motion for leave to file the amicus brief. But one of the things we pointed out in there, and we were respectful of Wisconsin manufacturers, it's certainly a good organization. It is a lobbying organization, but it is a good organization. We pointed out that they were uninformed about certain things that had to do with this case. And I note for the record that Wisconsin manufacturers has not submitted a brief on the merits of the appeal today. Now, I can't speak for them. I certainly won't tell you why they made that decision. I like to think it's they saw our brief, they concluded that perhaps they weren't as fully informed as they ought to be, and maybe they rethought their position. We can't know that. What we can know is they did not choose to participate in the merits of this appeal, and they have not submitted a brief on the merits. Let me turn now to the issues before the court. First, I don't think there's any dispute that notice pleading is the rule in Wisconsin. I was reading this court's recent decisions just this month in preparation for today's hearing, and this court unanimously, just on March 7th, in the CED Properties decision authored for the court by Justice Crooks, reaffirmed that notice pleading is the standard. There are many other cases by this court, the cases are legion over the last 20 years, holding that as the Wisconsin standard, and they hold that as even so in antitrust cases, that being the Meyer case, antitrust cases being perhaps the most lengthy and expensive type of cases one could possibly embark upon.
Counselor, your opposing counsel, in response to one of my questions about 180.0828, asserted that statute is a general statement of liability, and in order to mount a sufficient complaint, you must plead with specificity facts sufficient, if true, to support one of the exceptions. Would you respond to my question to him, but now it's a question to you. And if you agree with him that you have to do that, tell me how you did it. If you don't think you have to do it, tell me why.
I don't think we have to do it.
Okay.
And although I think we did plead facts with specificity, but let me explain to Your Honor, to Your Honor, Justice Rogenczak, why we don't have to do it. And that is because the statute on its face requires the person asserting liability to prove that the breach or failure to perform constitutes, and it goes on and on and on. Had the legislature wanted to require the plaintiff to plead something, it could have said, unless the plaintiff pleads and proves. And by the way, I would also point out that in, you know, there is this concern that the defendants express about these sorts of shareholder lawsuits. I will point out that the legislature, where it has found there to be excessive litigation, has proven itself more than able to adopt statutes. For example, I noticed that within the last several years, the Wisconsin Prisoner Litigation Reform Act was adopted because of this perception by the legislature that there were too many prisoner lawsuits. The legislature certainly can enact a statute requiring the pleading standards that the defendants are asking us to do here if they want, but they haven't done so. And Your Honor, I will say one other thing that those of us who regularly read the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times know, and that is that the Wisconsin legislature is not afraid to act no matter how controversial the issue may be.
Well, we don't have a lot of these kind of lawsuits in Wisconsin, frankly.
I'm sorry.
We do not have a lot of lawsuits like this in Wisconsin, and I think opposing counsel is correct. Most of them end up in Delaware because they've got the body of law that people can rely on, and both sides seem to know better what they're doing. So this is not something that has come before any court in Wisconsin on any kind of a regular basis. So we have cases going way back to the 1800s on some issues. It's just not something that we see on a regular basis.
Well, that is true. And clearly, that I think shows that there is no litigation problem in Wisconsin with too many of these lawsuits being brought in. I think we've counted five over the last 10 years. I certainly would not suggest that that's the same sort of problem that would that some people could perceive with some other types of litigation. But the point.
Now, in answer to my question, you said you didn't have to plead the exceptions to 180.828, but you did it. Do you want to refer me to the paragraphs where you think you did it?
Yes. Yes, ma'am. Yes, yes. We allege that the Pauls sought to sell Renaissance as part of their personal retirement strategy at a bad time. That is paragraph 46.
Okay.
And Justice Rogenczak, I think a fair analogy might be something like this. To suppose that, because defendants do acknowledge in their brief that there was a financial turmoil in the markets at this time, right? So this was not the time to get the best price for the company. And the only reason, frankly, to sell would be if you wanted to retire and move to Colorado.
That goes to the argument that opposing counsel said was one of the choices. They should not have sold this company, right?
At this time, that is correct. Okay. Or they should have sold their own interest. And I think the analogy that I think would be an apt one would be if two people owned, for example, an apartment building, and they both happened to live there, and at the height of the real estate crisis, one decided they wanted to retire and move to Colorado, could they then force the other owner of the apartment building to sell at the market's bottom if they owe them a fiduciary duty, or could they cause the directors to do that? And that is what we allege here. Your Honor, we also allege that there are certain things that suggest that Renaissance was worth more. For example, we point to a report that Renaissance's free cash flow of 6.4% was higher than any educational software company with a value of more than $250 million. That's the complaint to paragraph 60.
Okay, then you're saying they got too little for it. That's what you're saying in paragraph 60.
Well, correct. We were saying they breached their duties by deciding to sell at this time.
Right.
And by getting too little. We allege that Primera's co-manager publicly stated that they were getting good deals at the time, Primera, at times of this panic, by taking advantage of the market downturn. That's paragraph 50.
I'm sorry, 50?
Paragraph 50.
Thank you.
We, of course, allege that Plato was willing to pay more, and they say it would be 30 cents a share more if the Pauls took the same percent as other shareholders did. We don't know why they were taking a different amount from Primera. But 30 cents a share is 30 cents a share. They also, by that time, had caused.
So that's too little. So now you're saying they should have sold it to Plato. I'm just trying to track what this goes to. So
yes.
That's your argument.
Yes. And they also, there is an allegation of the $13 million termination fee that Plato would have had to pay, which, of course, would be reflected in the size of the offer that Plato was able to make. As we break that down, that's about 45 cents a share added on to the 30 cents a share.
Okay, so, and what paragraph is that in?
Paragraph 52.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. There's also paragraph 54, that the Pauls turned down Plato for allegedly selfish reasons. They admitted it was their own self-serving reasons. Of Plato having a longer time frame at odds with their retirement.
Okay, so again, you think that Plato was a better sale, so they should have sold it to Plato.
Well, they should have either not sold the company until they could get an appropriate price, or at a minimum, they should have taken the Plato offer, which was a higher offer.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay.
Plato also was in the same business, though, weren't they? Weren't they in the business of educational materials, and was there any concern about their being able to pass antitrust regs in order to do this deal or not?
Not that I saw expressed, Your Honor, but certainly not in the complaint. And I think Plato said that again, these are all facts that would be developed during discovery. Your Honor, we also allege that the Pauls admit that they turned down the bid for Plato because of concern about claims, lawsuits that might be brought against themselves individually. And, of course, there's a license. This is paragraph 54. And then there's paragraph 55.
Okay, so
I'm sorry.
What license? I'm sorry. The license for their little company, non-exclusive, non-commercial license?
That's the one. Yes,
okay,
sir.
Gotcha. Okay.
There's also allegations with respect to the directors, that they allowed the Pauls to cause Renaissance to hire their personal banker, Goldman Sachs, paragraph 47, that they allowed the Pauls to choose the timing of the sale of the company, paragraph 49, and that they abdicated the decision to sell, the timing of the sale, and the choice of the purchaser to the Pauls, paragraph 47 to 49. Also in those paragraphs are allegations that the Pauls were running the show through their personal banker, Goldman Sachs.
Well, one of these deals like this always closed through an investment banker, right? It's going to close through an investment banker. You're not going to, people are not going to do this kind of a deal themselves.
Well, I think it is correct to say, it's not in the complaint, but it is correct to say that oftentimes people will retain an investment banker. Our issue is with the choice of investment banker. They chose the Paul's investment banker.
Well, what did they do in the complaint that was wrong? What did Goldman Sachs do that you alleged was wrong?
That they had an incentive to steer the sale of the company in the first instance, number one, because they were only going to get that huge fee, multi-million-dollar fee, if the company were sold.
Well,
and they had an incentive to steer it to the sale of the Paul's preferred buyer, Permira, because they were the Paul's personal banker and had a relationship with the Paul's.
Well, but the choice of sale comes down to whether the directors and the shareholders vote majority-wise, both of them, to go forward, right?
Well, the Pauls, remember, own 60-something percent of the share.
Sure. And they were listed, I think, in all the writings I've seen that you folks have given us about this was a company that was controlled by a group of shareholders.
But there was no suggestion that independent shareholders had a non-Paul shareholders had any sort of choice in this matter. This was a sale that was dictated by the Pauls. And with respect to the directors were, because the Pauls are majority shareholders, elected by the Pauls. So had the directors not followed the Pauls' chosen course of action, pursuing a sale of the company at this time and pursuing a sale to Plato, they would have been presumably voted off the board at the very next opportunity by the Pauls, in which case they would not have gotten any of those acceleration of options that would be caused by attorney.
How are your clients any different than majority shareholders in any publicly traded company? I mean, there's a market for the shares. If they don't like that there's a group that runs this company because they own so much of it, why don't they just invest someplace else? I don't see how they're any different than any minority shareholder in a publicly traded company.
Well, I guess, Justice Rogensack, it depends on what sense you mean by different. I mean, are they minority shareholders who were subject to oppression and alleged breaches of fiduciary duties?
We have statutes in Wisconsin that talk about oppression. I think Jorgensen, that was mentioned by opposing counsel, talks about that, cites the standard and what you have to prove. But you didn't allege oppression.
No, we alleged a breach of fiduciary duty, which I think we've heard the defendants acknowledge that the Pauls and clearly the directors owed fiduciary duties to the plaintiff and the minority shareholders. And a breach of fiduciary duty, or a fiduciary duty has been defined, as we point out in our briefs, in Wisconsin, as the duty to put the interests of someone else before those of your own. So that's what we allege. The duty the directors breached here.
Does oppression violate fiduciary duty?
Clearly it would, I would say, yes.
Seems to me breach of fiduciary duty is a sort of umbrella that has a lot of different things in it, like conflict of interest, oppression.
Yes, I agree, Chief Justice. The breach of fiduciary duty is much broader than oppression.
Had they decided to go ahead and do what the minority wants and do a deal with Plato instead of Permira, and the deal with Plato fell through, could the minority then sue the majority for breach of fiduciary duty for blowing the other deal by passing it up?
Yeah, the answer is I don't know. I haven't contemplated that situation. I suppose there.
I mean, it shouldn't it be something more than just, I prefer this deal over that deal. And, I mean, shouldn't the business judgment rule play some role in the analysis in that it, is it really that no matter what they choose to do, you can sue them and state a cause of action just because you can then second guess and say, oh, I wish it were the other one? No matter what they do, you can say, I'd like the other one and sue them. Is that really how this is supposed to work?
Well, I think there are two distinct issues, right? One is what the plaintiff will ultimately have to prove its case. And as Justice, the Chief Justice noted, at this point, both sides are paying their own attorney's fees. That's the way these things work. So the plaintiff has no incentive to pursue the case unless there's some prospect of ultimate success from the plaintiff's perspective, right?
Who has the burden of proof on that these decisions fall within the business judgment rule or the statute?
Were you done answering my question? I'm just not sure that you – I felt like you were just warming up for the hit it out of the park moment. I'm sort of curious about the answer, actually.
You should answer that question if you have
to. Okay. Can you repeat your question, please, Justice Ziegler? I want to make sure.
I was just trying to figure out what, if any, role the business judgment rule has in this, if you can always second-guess what deal was made and sue someone on that and claim that you deserve more.
Right.
Where does the judgment come into that, or doesn't it? Should it be that no matter what they do, whether they cut the first deal or the second deal, that can always be brought into court, and you can say, I wish I would have had the other one. Shouldn't it be more than that is my question.
Well, again, as we discussed at the beginning and as the Court of Appeals held, the business judgment rule, the statute, 180.0828, just does not talk about what needs to be pled. So you're operating under Wisconsin's notice pleading rules. Okay.
So is the answer, yeah, you can do that?
The answer is, I guess, a lot of people can sue a lot of people for different things under notice pleading standards, and at some point evidence is required. That is typically at the summary judgment stage, and or if one gets past summary judgment to trial. The evidence would have to be of a breach of fiduciary duty.
Right. You're going further, though. I'm just saying, so someone can state a valid claim just because they allege, I wish I would have had the other deal.
No, well, there's much more than that here, right? There were allegations that the Pauls drove this process to their own personal interest and that the directors, other directors, allowed them to do that.
So long as you allege those things, you can second-guess the deal.
Where people have an interest in the transaction, where the directors have a self-interest in the transaction, where they're allegedly engaged in self-dealing, where the majority shareholders are allegedly engaged in self-dealing. Yes, one.
What was the self-dealing here?
Selling the company at the time when the market was down, but the Pauls wished to sell the whole company, not just their stock, and they wished to do that for their own personal reasons, i.e. their desire to retire and move to Colorado.
Why would anyone ever want to be a majority shareholder?
Well,
I mean, the minority decides it all under your logic. We're not communicating with each other somehow very effectively. If being majority shareholder means you can't sell out, you can't retire, you can't make sure the minority gets paid more than you do, and no matter what you do, so long as someone says, I wish you would have done something else, you're stuck.
No, Your Honor, we have no dispute that the Pauls could have sold their own shares. That seems to be the law. So the Pauls had every right to share their shares in the company. What we take issue with is they're forcing all the shareholders to sell.
So they don't owe any fiduciary duty. They could have sold this to anyone. The minority could be stuck with someone they can't stand running the company. They could drive it into the ground. The majority could sell it to someone who really wanted to deep six the company, get out, and the minority would not, they think that's okay? I mean, there are people who buy companies just to terminate them so that they don't have that company to compete against them. So the minority saying they'd prefer having something like that?
Right. Well, no. I mean, I think the usual reason people buy companies or would buy a majority share in the company would be because they wanted to make money, right? So people would be stuck with them. And in a situation where somebody bought a majority share in the company in order to terminate the company because they didn't want to compete with them, to drive the company into the ground, notwithstanding their own investment, I think there would clearly be a cause of action against the new owner for breach of fiduciary duty, for oppression, for all the sorts of other things that the Chief Justice referred to before. So the Pauls, as I understand Wisconsin law, had every right to sell their own shares in the company. We don't take issue with that. And it may be that somebody else became the majority shareholder, that somebody else would have fiduciary duties to the minority shareholders and could not oppress them. So maybe it's unclear why they would be disliked, but if they were disliked, as long as they were complying with their fiduciary duties, they, you know, wouldn't minority shareholders would have to live with them.
So the majority is limited to selling their own shares unless the majority approves. The majority is limited to selling their own shares unless the minority approves.
The majority is limited to selling their own shares, or they can cause a sale of the company, entire company, if it does not breach their fiduciary duties to the minority. And again, the plaintiff has to prove a breach of fiduciary duty. It's a burden of proof is always going to be on the plaintiff. But the question here today is, do we state a claim? Do we get to the discovery that the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times thought was so important that we get to in this very case?
Why didn't Theta Key Partners buy out the majority?
Theta Key Partners was not interested, and I'm not necessarily sure it had the financial wherewithal to buy out the majority. And it didn't have an obligation to buy out the majority. Theta Key Partners just was a shareholder, sat there, breaches of fiduciary duty, alleged breaches of fiduciary duty came to it. And it has the right to bring a lawsuit and to seek to prove those breaches of fiduciary duty in the court. And that is what the Court of Appeals held, Justice Prosser. And by the way, I'd like to address one other issue, which is we have many Delaware cases cited by the defendants. And actually, we point out there is a Third Circuit case. And I actually began my career as a law clerk to a judge on the Third Circuit, so I'm well familiar with that. But the Third Circuit had an exhaustive analysis in In Re Tower Air, and it really took issue with the Delaware courts. It said what the Delaware courts apply is not notice pleading. It's not the notice pleading standard that then existed in the federal courts. Clearly not the notice pleading standard that exists in Wisconsin. And it, in fact, directed district courts within the Third Circuit that they were not to consider, not to look to, any Delaware decisions on motions to dismiss, even where the substantive law issues under that involved Delaware law.
If I understand the argument, both you and Mr. Meadow at least agree that a shareholder can sell a stock. Fence tracked back, Mr. Meadow tracked it back to an early 19th century Wisconsin Supreme Court case. This case involves sale that involved the whole corporation.
That is correct.
Which puts things in a different light. Who has the burden of proof to show that the corporation, the directors were in using business judgment and that they fall within the exceptions as business judgment? Is that an affirmative defense?
No. Yes, Your Honor. I believe it is an affirmative defense, but I also believe it's been referred to, as Your Honor pointed out before, and read it as an evidentiary presumption. So I think at trial, the plaintiff may have that burden.
Counselor, I thought you just told me that the people who are alleging such a breach, at least under 180.0828, had the burden to prove. And that's why it wasn't a pleading standard, which would mean that you folks have the burden to prove, and it's not an affirmative defense. Maybe did I misunderstand your answer when we first started talking?
I think the answer is it's unclear. I think there is the Regent case that talks, as I said, about it being an evidentiary presumption that they acted in good faith, which suggests to me that it may be the burden on plaintiff to prove at trial. Yes, it's an evidentiary presumption that attaches at trial to the defendant, to the directors, and the plaintiff has the burden of proving, rebutting that evidentiary presumption.
Well, you know, if you're right, and it's for the defendant to raise as an affirmative defense, then 180.0828, I don't know, it says, unless the person asserting liability, that seems to me to be you, proves that the breach of failure or breach or failure to perform constitutes any of the following. So there's a blanket immunity, and then it says the person asserting liability proves.
Right, right.
That doesn't sound like an affirmative defense to me.
Right. Well, as I said, Regent refers to it as an evidentiary presumption, which suggests to me that the plaintiff has the burden of proof at trial. Yes.
Well, paragraph 19 says, here the directors have raised the business judgment rule as a defense.
I'm sorry, Chief Justice.
Paragraph 19 of Regent says the directors raise business judgment rule as a defense.
Yeah, well, then, Your Honor, I misspoke, and Regent does talk about
it. The reason I ask a question is I don't know the answer.
Okay.
Some of the stuff I read here was that the business judgment rule is a defense.
Okay. Well, Regent
and
is clear.
Then I read there's an evidentiary rule, and then I read immunity. So, you know, and right in Regent, sometimes it's referred to as an evidentiary matter. Sometimes it's referred to as immunity. So I'm just not sure.
Well, Your Honor, I think we all agree that Regent is the most recent and important Wisconsin Supreme Court case. On the issue of the business judgment.
Is it significant that Regent is a summary judgment case?
Yes, and in fact, that is another very important issue, Justice Crooks, is that every Wisconsin case to date to apply the business judgment rule or to apply 180.0828 has done so either after trial or on summary judgment. No Wisconsin appellate case has applied it on a motion to dismiss.
And
Your Honor, again, we submit that that speaks volumes to Wisconsin's notice pleading standard and to the fact that the plaintiff does not have to plead evidence and the plaintiff does not have to plead facts with specificity. It is a notice pleading standard unanimously affirmed by this court just a couple weeks ago that requires a plaintiff to give notice to the defendants of what his claim is, and that's clearly been done here, as you can see, frankly, by the defendant's papers. They clearly understand what our claim is. I see my time is up. Unless Your Honors have any questions, I'm happy to stand. I'll stand down. Maybe just one more note, which is I heard Justice Gableman speak in the earlier case about the need to have a uniform standard, and one that didn't require balancing or weighing facts. I would suggest that sort of interest would be grossly disserved by applying the business judgment rule.
So now that you bring this subject up, I heard the Chief Justice a few minutes ago preface a question to you with, well, everybody agrees that the majority shareholders could have sold their shares, no problem. But then the second part of it was an observation which, well, in this instance, they sold the whole corporation, which puts a different light on it. That was the phrase she used. You didn't directly respond to that, so I want to ask you, does it, from a legal perspective, put a different light on it?
Yes.
By definition?
Yes, I believe it does, because they are forcing other shareholders to sell their shares, which they would not be doing if they sold their own shares individually.
Isn't that done every day in the business world? If it's duly authorized by the board of directors, isn't that something that's, I mean, I may be wrong, but isn't that a fairly common thing for corporations to do?
to sell the company, the entirety of the company, where there's a majority shareholder who has a different interest than the other shareholders? I submit that that's not regularly done.
But you, and the different interest here, you're saying, is that the Pauls wanted to retire.
They expressed their intent to retire and to sell at the bottom of the market in order to retire. They then expressed a view preference to sell to the low bidder, not to the high bidder.
And then in response, well, but there were some factors there that apparently were taken into consideration.
The defendants say that. They may have the opportunity to show those one day. They're not at the motion to dismiss stage, where notice pleading, again, is the Wisconsin standard. The plaintiff is not required to prove, to plead evidence at this standard.
Okay, so it's enough. So getting back to the subject which you raised and in your last statement, which now no doubt you are regretting, the rule that we take away from this case to apply to all similarly situated, according to you, would be what?
That I don't think there is any new rule. I think the rule is we're going to apply the Wisconsin notice pleading standard to this case as we apply it to every other case, including antitrust cases.
Let's say you were writing. The Chief Justice has a very good opinion, question, which she often asks, and I now borrow it, which is, let us say you are back in your law clerk days, not at the Third Circuit, but here at the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And you are asked to draft the opinion in this case. The holding in this case is what?
The holding in this case would be this case involves a straightforward application of Wisconsin's notice pleading standard, the business judgment rule, the business judgment statute on its face has never been applied at the motion to dismiss stage in Wisconsin. There is a Third Circuit case that says it should not be applied at the motion to dismiss stage. That's the Tower Air case. And we're going to allow plaintiff is not required to plead evidence. It's not required to plead facts with specificity. We're going to allow this case to go to summary judgment like we do every other case in Wisconsin. And at the summary judgment stage, the court may or may not, trial court may or may not grant summary
usually judgment. There might be some reference to the facts in a holding, and it is enough. It is enough for the minority shareholders to show that the majority shareholders wanted to retire. Is that what I'm hearing?
No, I would elaborate on that. I would. The facts are in our complaint. And I went
right.
Through the
in addition, rules. with the competing bids, where
with the competing bids and with the special license that was granted to them,
yes.
And there were lots of specific facts and the fact that the process was steered towards Premier at the beginning, and there wasn't the negotiation with Plato until after there was the agreement to pay the $13 million termination fee, and the fact that the Pauls admitted and that they turned down Plato, for admittedly self-interested reasons, i.e. the longer time frame, concern about claims against themselves individually, the license, and that's paragraph 54, and the indemnity, paragraph 55, and the investment banker that they caused the company to hire, their own personal investment banker, so that personal investment banker was not in a position to advise the Pauls. I'm sorry, was not in a position to disinterestedly look at this from the interest of all the shareholders, but had a focus on serving the interests of the Pauls, and the fact that the entirety of the multi-million-dollar investment banker fee, which was negotiated by the Pauls, so they had the role with Goldman Sachs, provided for the entirety of its multi-million-dollar fee to be contingent on a sale closing, and then they then used the fairness opinion to tout the fairness opinion for the sale, and that the other directors, abdicated their responsibility and allowed the Pauls to do all of this.
Thank you, and I thank my colleagues for indulging my questions after the red light.
Thank you for letting me go over time to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baraldi, and you're no longer authorized to appear in the Wisconsin courts. Nothing personal.
Right.
Mr. Apfel.
Your Honor. I'd like to begin my final comments where I started, and that is this case is not about notice pleading. It is not about specificity. It is about whether what the well-pleaded facts that are contained in the complaint set forth a claim upon which relief can be granted. And when you examine those, you see that this is at its heart a dispute about business judgment. What was the best price? What was the best thing to do under the circumstances?
Counsel, this is my problem. It appears to me that this is about pleading, and it is about the business judgment rule and where the business judgment rule comes into play. Does it come in at the pleading stage, or does it come in at the evidentiary stage? So could you address that? Because I think it is about pleading and where the business judgment rule. Everyone thinks that businesses should be able to conduct their daily activities and their and their vision for their company as a company. But this case, I think, is about pleading, and where does the business judgment rule come in, evidence or pleading stage?
Well, clearly our answer is at the pleading stage. And to say that there may be some questions that could someday present evidentiary problems doesn't get around the fact that for purposes of a motion to dismiss, you assume they're going to come up with the evidence to prove it. So what, in fact, did they prove here or plead here? I'm sorry.
May you also – would you please also – address in this context, I look at the statutes. I see that I think it's 80203 talks about what has to be pled with particularity in this state. The legislature has said you have to plead with particularity fraud and mistake, and then goes on to explain that. And then 80203 sub 6 says libel and slander have to be pled with particularity. This doesn't appear in the statute. And the business judgment rule talks about proving, not pleading. So those are all of my concerns intertwined that cause me to think that this is about pleading.
Well, forgive me then if my answer is somewhat intertwined as well. Okay. And the first part of the answer is, remember, we are talking both about the immunity statute as well as the business judgment rule. The second aspect is that There could conceivably be and possibly is some aspect of particularity required in this case. To the extent that there is any notion that some of this breach consists of fraud, fraud, of course, must be pleaded with particularity. But the most important response here is that the fact that a rule requires certain things to be pleaded with particularity and by implication others not doesn't mean that you ignore the facts that the plaintiff chose to put into the complaint with particularity when you find them there. And when you do find them there, you have to take a look at them and say, what is the implication? What do these things do? And if you look at the particular facts that are pleaded here, take, for example, the first decision point, to sell or to hold. What do we know here? We know that, according to the allegations of the complaint itself, it was Permira who first approached Renaissance. We know that it represented a substantial premium over market. There is no allegation in this complaint that the price was inadequate. What counsel for Dedeky tries to do is he says, well, we alleged that this was a time of turmoil. They sold at the bottom of the market when, you know, the Pauls were interested in retiring. Well, as Mr. Meadow explained, you know, courts that have looked at this very closely, particularly now Chief Justice Strine in the Synthesis case, have determined that an allegation of a mere desire to retire is not sufficient to give rise to any implication that you're going to throw your otherwise normal economic considerations to the wind. But there is no pleading that they sold at the bottom of the market, and why not? Because such a pleading is impossible. You evaluate the actions of the defendants at the time they are made, and during a time of turmoil, no one knows that you're at the bottom of the market. For all you know, the market may be down to, you know, heretofore unplumbed depths. You make your decision on the basis of the facts as they present themselves. And in that regard, I'd like to point out an excerpt from the complaint itself. In speaking of the Plato offer, Now, an offer which, for purposes of the minority, was a mere 30 cents above the Permira offer. What does one of the blogsters say? That the Plato offer was one of the richest deals in the industry, second only to one other in large deals of this type of company. There simply is no allegation of the complaint that this price was inadequate. Turn, then, to the next decision. Stick with the bird in the hand or abandon the bird in the hand to try to get 1.018 birds that are still in the bush. I mean, phrasing it alone ought to suggest the answer to that question. But the complaint affirmatively alleges that the Poles were concerned about the timing, and they were also concerned about the resulting combination itself. This was the wrong partner. Now,
counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Red light is on. Finish.
If I may. Counsel attempts to portray that as personal, but in fact, in both of those respects, the interests of the Pauls were no different than the interests of the other shareholders. They wanted to make sure that a deal was done, and a deal was done with the right party. And that being the case, the affirmative allegations of the complaint demand the dismissal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Apfeld, and thank you, Mr. Meadow, and thank you, Mr. Rowaldi, for your arguments today on a issue that the court has not had for a number of years. And thank you for your briefs on this issue. That concludes our hearing in 12 AP 1967, Data Key Partners versus Permira Advisors, LLC. We have students, I believe, who are coming in, and Justice Prosser will meet with them. He will be right out, and you may be joined by other students who were here earlier. We are in recess till 1:30 when we'll have our third case.